Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for this special Victoria Day holiday edition of the program. My name is Magnus Thiewald. I'll be your host for this hour. We have a special holiday edition, and we're going to bring you some encore presentations of some interviews we've done recently, along with our regular feature on looking at Lyme. It's a nice day out there. Not as nice as it could be. Probably isn't beach weather, which is rather unfortunate for a day off like today. I hope you're enjoying your day off. With the show today, we're going to look. We're going to speak to Stanis Smith, who's a Burnaby resident, pushing back against new Nav Canada flight routes over North Burnaby. We're going to talk to Dr. Ruth Joy about orcas in the Salish Sea and the impact of shipping traffic there. Plus, we'll be bringing you Looking at Lyme. That's what's up on the show today. Let's get going. Joining me today is Stanis Smith, who's a Burnaby resident, who is not happy with the new flight routes proposed by Nav Canada, the national agency that manages Canadian airspace. The new routes will bring more planes over North Burnaby neighborhoods. Thanks for joining me today, Stanis.
My pleasure.
You have started a petition that calls for Nav Canada to reconsider these changes. What are some of your concerns?
Well, I have a number of concerns. For people who are not aware of this proposal, it was announced late last year that Nav Canada is going to be consolidating all of the air traffic in the Greater Vancouver region. And what that means is that they're taking the air traffic, which right now is quite dispersed, and they're channeling it into what I would call freeways in the air. And they have said on their in their public announcements that these changes are being made in the name of enhancement of safety, modernizing procedures, and demand, and those may well be the case. However, there is very significant impact to a number of residential areas, and I would add to SFU, because one of the main freeways will go pretty well directly over SFU at a very low altitude.
Yeah, I've seen that route. It comes right over the campus.
Exactly. And my concerns are several. The first is that in the information that Nav Canada has made public, they're using outdated standards for noise contours. And without getting too much into the technical details, they are using noise thresholds that have been superseded many years ago by the World Health Organization and a number of other entities. So in simple terms, the noise levels that they consider to be acceptable are double or more than double what the World Health Organization and others recommend. Nav Canada has also not proposed any mitigation measures, or certainly they haven't disclosed any that they've made public or spoken about alternatives such as different routes, such as moving capacity to Abbotsford rather than YVR, such as curfews at night, which many cities have. So there's no consideration of ways in which these new routes would potentially cause less of impact. And my final major reservation is that there's a lack of due process and transparency. The way these have been put out to the public is that these are the routes that Nav Canada has decided upon, and we are invited to comment on them. However, there's been no due process about how they even came up with them in the first place.
Right. So you're talking about a lot of technical aspects of this, but you're not just a resident of Burnaby who might be affected by this. You do have some expertise in this area. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Well, yes, I've been involved in airport design for most of my professional career. I'm currently working on projects in the States, and so I bring that perspective. And there is a certain irony to me taking this position, And obviously, I have a vested interest. I'm in one of the areas that will be affected. But I think increasingly people are realizing that noise pollution is a major consideration. It's a major health consideration. And to the extent that these routes are going to impact real people on the ground who live in residential areas, I think that the potential impacts are very serious, not to mention, of course, the potential economic impacts to people who are now going to be living in areas that will probably see some depreciated value as a result of being in a flight path.
Right. So you mentioned a bit about sort of the process, and as you describe it, Nav Canada makes the decision, and then there's an invitation for some comments. But what's the process after that? I mean, what do the comments mean?
Well, it's a great question, and obviously, to the extent that Nav Canada is going to take those comments into consideration, I think you would need to ask them. However, Nav Canada is an independent entity; it's not answerable directly to the public. It's only answerable to Transport Canada. Transport Canada sets the regulatory authority. And so our petition is a very simple and I think very reasonable request for an independent environmental assessment of these potential routes. And if this project was anything other than a airspace, if it was, let us say, a new freeway going through a residential area, or if it was a new major infrastructure project, it would automatically trigger an environmental assessment before the new routes were actually designed. So I think that our request, which is it's a Government of Canada petition, where we already have the prerequisite number of signatures on it. It's a request to Transport Canada to exercise their authority and undertake an independent environmental assessment with emphasis on the independence, because all of the materials that Nav Canada has produced so far have been internally generated or generated by consultants hired by Nav Canada.
So what is the threshold for the petition, and how many have you got so far?
The threshold's 500. We have we're getting close to 900.
Yes.
So, and we'd love to get more, because obviously the more people that see this as being a concern, the more likely it is that Transport Canada will pay attention. And I think that certainly from the point of view of SFU, anybody taking a look at those maps has every reason for serious concern. Mm-hmm. The aircraft will be lower than 5,000 feet as they go over SFU. And I'm not sure what altitude SFU is at. It's at several hundred feet at any rate. So
yeah, like 1,300 feet.
Right. So this is going to be a very significant noise issue directly over SFU, not just, of course, for the tuition spaces, but for people who are living on the hill.
Mm-hmm. So what do you say to people who say, well, the planes have to fly somewhere? Why not over North Burnaby?
What I say is, firstly, the same, you know, let's think about Vancouver in the 1950s, when people proposed to take all of the dispersed traffic and put it into freeways. And citizens of Vancouver said, no, we're not interested in that. And I think as a result, Vancouver is a more livable city. Well, I think we'd all agree that when you look at other cities who chose the freeway route. And this is a direct analogy. I mean, what we're talking about here are freeways in the sky. Nav Canada in their materials have said that 61,000 homes will be, or 61 fewer homes will be impacted. And I would say that at the minimum, that is highly misleading, because the criteria they're using are outdated criteria. I think if they were to use current thresholds of noise that are accepted by respected entities such as the World Health Organization, they would find that that the impacts are very significant. So that's what I would say to people. The other thing I would say is that many cities our size have more than one airport. You can think of many airports, many cities that have two airports. And there is another perfectly viable airport out there in Abbotsford. And the irony of this whole situation is that the residents of Tri-Cities, Burnaby, New West are going to be paying the price for enhancements to YVR, when in fact their closest airport is Abbotsford.
Right.
So there really is an irony there from my perspective.
So if I understand what you're saying, I mean, these changes aren't just moving the roots, but they're concentrating. So the areas that are affected will be seeing perhaps more flights than any particular area under paths now. Is that correct?
Exactly.
All right. So is there any established appeal process for these kind of changes other than what you're doing right now with the petition?
The only appeal process that I am aware of is to appeal directly to NAV Canada, which I and a number of people have done.
Yep.
And to appeal to Transport Canada to exercise its authority to undertake an independent environmental assessment. And Transport Canada has that authority.
All right. And have you heard of any other communities being successful in this kind of appeal?
Well, this is the first time that the airspace in Canada is being materially changed in many decades.
Right.
So this is an unprecedented situation.
Interesting. Well, how do people find out more about your petition and the issue, and where can they go and join the petition if they're interested?
I'd encourage everybody to take a look at the website that we've launched. It's nooverflights.com. That's nooverflights.com. And on that website, you'll see a lot of materials and obviously the link to the petition. And we really would encourage people, if they are concerned, to sign the petition and help us to hopefully move this in a direction that's going to be better for all concerned.
Well, thank you for joining me today, Stannis. Stannis R. Smith is a Burnaby resident and architect who's worked on airport design around the world or around North America. Thank you for joining me today.
Okay. Thank you for your interest.
Thank you.
Bye now.
That was Stannis Smith speaking about the new NAV Canada air routes. Stannis Smith is an architect and airport designer, and he's pushing back against the new flight routes with a petition that you can find online. Let's have a quick look at the weather. Looks like a typical spring day out there for Vancouver. It's going to be sunny with cloudy periods, but a 30% chance of showers this afternoon. More of the same tomorrow and Wednesday. Things improving a bit on Thursday, but it's not going to be glorious weather. It's going to be pretty much a mix of sun and cloud throughout the week. Highs 17, 18 degrees next few days, up to 21, 22 degrees later in the week. That's your Vancouver weather. Next up, we have an interview with Dr. Ruth Joy. You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Recently, CJSF spoke to Dr. Ruth Joy of SFU's Department of Environmental Science, and also an adjunct professor in the Department of Statistics. She and her colleagues have been researching and following orca whales in the Salish Sea and looking at the impacts of shipping on those populations. As you may know, the orca populations in our region have been under a lot of stress, and particularly the southern resident orca population. Here's my interview with Dr. Ruth Joy.
And you've been studying the southern resident population of killer whales in the Salish Sea. And we hear quite a bit about the troubles that that population is having, and I guess J-POD in particular. But can you tell us more about this group and the challenges they're facing?
Yeah, so they're culturally distinct and quite unique group of killer whales. And they've had a number of challenges because particularly their summer range overlaps with the busy waters of the Salish Sea. And that's an area that has had a lot of industrial development. It's the Port of Vancouver, as well as home to many other industrial projects down through not just Canadian waters, but down into the US as well. And lots of pile driving and other sources of noise beyond ships. Also a popular location for recreational fishing, commercial fishing, and a lot of other anthropogenic sources of change in the environment. And so the Fraser River, for example, is one of the biggest rivers on the west coast of North America, but it in itself has had many challenges. And how that relates to southern resident killer whales is that their favorite thing they like to eat is Chinook salmon. And with various things that have gone on in the last 50 or so years, the Chinook salmon and multiple different populations that migrate up the Fraser River are also status of, endangered. So that means their prey is endangered and they themselves are endangered. So it's a tough go for southern resident killer whales in the southern resident in the Salish Sea.
So you described them as culturally distinct, I think was the word you used. What does that mean?
It means that there's many different groups of killer whales around the world. They're present from the Arctic down into the Antarctic. And they each group has its own culture. And that means that their language, so to speak, is unique to within that group. And killer whales spend their entire lives with their family and in what we call matrilineal lines. And so there's a strong sense of sociability amongst the killer whales, and very fascinating work that others have done that I encourage you to look at. But basically, they spend their lives with their sisters and brothers within a group. The mothers in the group keep with their offspring for their entire lives, and they intermix with other pods, so other matrilineal lines. And so, for example, for J clan, which is what we consider be the southern resident killer whales, there's three matrilineal lines, J, K, and L, and each of them has some calls that are unique within, or so call types, I mean that by what we might consider to be a word, I guess might be, we don't really understand killer whale language, but something along the lines of they have unique words within each of their pods, but also a shared language amongst those three pods. And those would be unique from, say, the northern resident killer whales, the offshore killer whales, as well as the transient killer whales. And all four of those groups of killer whales are found in the waters off of British Columbia. And each has its own unique culture. Right.
So the clans and groups are matrilineal. So is there mating mixing going on between different groups to maintain to genetic diversity?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So not between the different ecotypes. So those four groups that I just mentioned, we call those ecotypes or populations. So they're the residents, the northern, it's quite complicated, but the northern residents and the southern residents are called a resident ecotype, and the northern and southerns are considered population. And the southern resident killer whale population is considered endangered. And within that population or clan, there are three matrilineal lines or pods. And those pods meet up into what we call super pods, and there's mixing amongst the different matrilineal lines.
That sounds very interesting. It'd be great to talk more and more about that, but we're actually here specifically to speak about some research you're doing on the impact of shipping specifically on this population.
Right, yeah.
So maybe you can tell us about that. And how does shipping, I mean, you mentioned a bit when you introduced yourself about the various noises, but how does shipping impact the whales?
Well, about 60% of the killer whale's brain is taken up for noise processing. So they have a different way of experiencing the world around them than us. They have eyes, but in the water, you can't see very far. It's dark after a certain depth, and there's lots of reasons why you can't see well underwater. And you'll know that if you've tried to dive down without goggles on. And even with goggles on, you just can't see very far. But sound moves about four and a half times faster in water than it does in air. And it can also move across ocean basins if it's quiet. And so some of the whales of the world will put themselves in particular locations and sing and attract mates. And so sound is an enormously important communication method for all whales, and for whales like southern resident killer whales that have the ability to echolocate, this is how they find their food. And so they make a noise in their using air that's released from an air sac and goes through what we call phonic lips. And those create high frequency bursts of sounds, which we can call echolocation clicks. And when those echolocation clicks hit an object, that creates an echo that then is received back by the whale and creates an image, so to speak, similar to how we think of as bat radar. And so unlike us, they hear with what we think is largely their jaw. And so the entire head receives that sound back. And there's all kinds of innovations that have evolved inside the head of a killer whale in order to be able to process those sounds. And so when you have vessels charging through their habitat, creating noise, for the most part, that sound is at lower frequency ranges. So not within the frequency range of killer whales, but there is sort of a bleeding of noise that goes up the frequency ranges that overlap with both the communication frequency ranges as well. And most importantly, when you're trying to find your food into these higher frequency ranges. So it just makes it harder to find fish.
And so in your research, sort of interesting looking at how you sort of went about it. So I'll ask you about that in a moment. But what you found is that this noise does seem to affect their feeding habits or their feeding times.
Yeah. So I would caution that it's hard to tell by looking at killer whales, because a lot of what happens is underwater. And mm-hmm. So what we've done recently with colleagues down in Washington State has been to position students and whale observers on land to observe whales so that you as a researcher are not causing additional disturbance to whales by being present close to the whales and making noise yourself, and also creating physical disturbance by your boat. So we've had teams of observers on San Juan Island, as well as teams of students at Saturna Island in Boundary Pass, and another set of students up at Eagle Eye near Robson Bight on the north end of Vancouver Island, looking at the northern residents. And so what we can see by observing from land is what we think we can see is changes in movement patterns of killer whales in relation to the tracks of boats, as well as we can look at changes in behavior. So it's fairly easy to tell if whales are socializing because they're extremely demonstrative, and it's easy to tell if they're beelining and traveling and not diving deeply, but it's hard to tell foraging. And so some whales are easier than others. Like if they are doing prey sharing at the surface, then that's quite obvious. So southern resident killer whales will share fish at the surface, and they will engage in certain behaviors that are identified as foraging. But there's some uncertainty around identifying foraging behavior. But it seems from the evidence that we've collected that both the noise level of ships, in one of the studies that we published recently, the noise level of ships goes down as the speed of the ship goes down. So we've created between 22% and 40% more opportunities for killer whales to forage by reducing that noise level. And then we've observed that from these vantage point surveys, we've observed that killer whales are less likely to stop foraging if there's less noise observed. So we've both looked at it from the noise perspective, measuring the sound levels on hydrophones, and also looked at it from observations of behavior. And we're sort of trying to make those two lines of evidence come together.
How useful has this research been now, and how much buy-in are you getting from either the shipping industry or the ports around changing shipping behavior?
Yeah, definitely. One of the projects that we're working on right now with the Port of Vancouver and with the DFO, Department of Fisheries and Oceans, is to forecast killer whale movement. And so we've got a lot of effort put on predicting movement based on historical movement paths, as well as real-time oceanographic variables like tidal state and current speeds. And so to back it up into the historical buy-in that we've had so far is that the first slowdown that I worked on was in 2017, and we slowed all of the commercial vessels, or we asked, I should say, all of the commercial vessels to slow down to 12 knots for a 16 nautical mile section of the shipping lane. And this was on the west side of on the east side of Harrow Strait, on the west side of San Juan Island. And we had, this is from memory, I'd have to look at the paper, but something like 60% of the commercial vessels self-reported participating. And so this is a voluntary slowdown. And this is the way that industry has gone about it to date. There hasn't been a legal action or a mandate coming from the federal government. It has been a port-led volunteer commercial vessel slowdown with buy-in from a commercial shipping industry. And that was in 2017. In last year, I'm not sure, 2021 numbers haven't been calculated yet, but in 2020, I think the self-reported buy-in was over 90%. Of ships were slowing down. So there has been an increase in voluntary slowdowns over that time. There has been an initiative that started last year coming out of ports in the US. So the Seattle port is starting to get on board with making their own changes to shipping routes and slowing down commercial vessels. So I would say that given how charismatic southern resident killer whales are, there's been a lot of buy-in from industry, as well as you can imagine, there's fear of ship collisions with southern resident killer whales. That would be like the worst kind of PR nightmare that any kind of shipping industry could wish upon itself. So I think it's a fairly easy sell that everyone cares about these whales, so let's do what we can, has been largely the attitude around anyone who's participating in these kinds of activities in the Salish Sea.
Do you have any sense of how far the impact of ship noise from where it originates affects whales? And is it something that could a lot of help be achieved by the routing of ships? And I know they already sort of travel along lanes already.
Yeah.
But is that a possibility? Is that something that's shown by your research so far?
So I think you're asking how far extent
how far does the impact of shipping noise reach from the ship, for starters? Okay. That's a simple question for starters.
It's not at all a simple question. And I would defer exact calculations to an acoustician, but I can give you some loose answer to what you're asking, and that is that in certain locations without land barriers, the noise of a ship can travel across an entire ocean basin. However, in the Salish Sea, we have a lot of islands and islands stop noise. So the noise itself, for example, if Harrow Strait, which is the waters between San Juan Island and Vancouver Island, is largely contained when the ship is in that strait within the strait. But having said that, it would fill the entire basin of Harrow Strait. And there's a lot we still have to understand about how noise affects the ability of killer whales to hunt. And so even though the noise fills, noise itself has various different frequency bands. And commercial vessels typically dominate the lower frequency bands. And so killer whales typically use higher frequency bands, but whales like humpback whales and fin whales, they use lower frequency bands because they don't use echolocation. So the relative impact of shipping is something that we're still trying to understand. And I think that's a, you know, and also a species specific.